We are today going to continue and conclude our two-session discussion of poetry. I want to thank all of those who sent me original poems, but whatever their merits, they didn't quite compete with the ones that I had chosen, so I'd have to leave those for another day. I'm going to start today with love poetry. There's a whole category of wonderful poems celebrating love or bemoaning love. And one famous one which will get us started is by Andrew Marvell that Eric has just told me is 18th century. I made a point of looking all these up and forgot many of them. Again, I'm only going to read excerpts. This is from a poem called To His Coy Mistress. And of course, the convention at the time was that the woman was to be shy and say, oh no, not yet, etc. and so on. And he's had it. So this is basically what to say if she keeps on saying no. And I'm just going to read excerpts. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness lady were no crime. Jump. 100 years should go to praise thine eyes and on thy forehead gaze. 200 to adore each breast, but 30,000 to the rest. An age at least to every part, and the last age should show your heart. For, lady, you deserve this state, nor would I love at lower rate. But at my back I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder all before us lie deserts of vast eternity. Bad rhyme. Thy beauty shall no more be found, nor in thy marble vault shall sound my echoing song, then worms shall try that long-preserved virginity. And your quaint honor turn to dust, and into ashes all my lust. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. And jump to the ending. Let us roll all our strength and all our sweetness up into one ball, and tear our pleasures with rough strife through the iron gates of life. Thus, though we cannot make our sun stand still, yet we will make him run. So, grab life boldly. Do it now. A very famous and very effective poem. Now that's to get, that's, oh, I don't know, effective. A good poem, whether it works, I don't know. And now I've got two actual where they've secured the lover, one spiritual and one more bodily. The first is a sonnet. Now, sonnet is a distinct form of poetry that has to have 14 lines divided into two units, an 8 and a 6, according to the rhyme scheme. And there's different kinds of sonnets. I think they usually have the same rhythm, which is the classic iambic pentameter. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Although they may differ. I am not a student of sonnets. But it's a brilliant little form because it gives you, with absolute rules, a chance to express brilliantly and eloquently a certain sentiment. This is what's called a Petrarch or Italian sonnet because of the rhyme scheme. And I'll just read you the rhymes. And just for exercise, you write down A, B, or whatever. The last line, word in other words, I'll read you of the 14 lines. This is, by the way, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, 1806 to 1861, from her book Sonnets from the Portuguese, and is simply number 43. She was the wife of Robert Browning, one of my top favorite poets, so they were a really high-powered family. And she has the 8 and 6 rhyme scheme, as you'll see. You write it down. Ways, height, sight, grace. Days, light, right, praise. That's the first. So it's A-B-B-A, A-B-B-A. And then use faith, lose breath, breath and faith, choose death. And that's not a negative, as you'll see in the context. So it's C-D, C-D, C-D. This is the octet and the sestet. This is really difficult to follow this form, but it's a way of, you'll see, of stressing certain words and sentiments. And this is a very beautiful declaration of love. And I just want you to grasp that certain phrases represent her rejection of a religious approach. When she says, for instance, I lose sight of the ends of being an ideal grace, she's losing sight of God. And because of her immersion in her lover. And the same is true when she says, I lose my saints, because she's found her hero. You see, so you have to get the idea that this is a very secular love scene, a love poem. This is very famous. How many of you don't know this, how do I love thee, let me count the ways? Well, there's a fair sprinkling. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight for the ends of being an ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with the passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And if God choose, I shall but love thee better after death. A beautiful expression of love. I thank you on her behalf. And judging from the poetry of her husband, she had a worthy cause to love there. Now here is a little more physical. I had them a lot more physical, but after discussing it with certain people, including my wife, we decided that we would just have a little suggestion of the physical, but you can go all the way. A listener to my radio show sent this in and said, in the erotica category, can this be surpassed? I think not. Well, it can be surpassed, but it's a beautiful poem by a great poet, Swinburne, Algernon Charles Swinburne. This is called Love and Sleep. He's 1837 to 1909, and I have a reference here to him who says, he is the poet whose verse celebrated a generation's liberation from the sexual constraints and intellectual absurdities of Christianity. So that's a strong recommendation right there. Plus, he loved love. Notice again, strong visual images complementing the auditory medium so that you're plunged, immersed, if you visualize the images, in a sensory world, and yet the intellectual content remains. As I say, it's called Love and Sleep. Wan, by the way, just simply means pale, and whist is old-fashioned for no. Lying asleep between the strokes of night, I saw my love lean over my sad bed, pale as the duskiest lily's leaf or head, smooth-skinned and dark, with bare throat made to bite, too wan for blushing and too warm for white, but perfect colored without white or red, and her lips opened amorously and said, I wist not what, saving one word, delight. And all her face was honey to my mouth, and all her body pasture to mine eyes. The long, lithe arms and hotter hands than fire, the quivering flanks, hair smelling of the south, the bright, light feet, the splendid, supple thighs, and glittering eyelids of my soul's desire. That's pretty good, don't you think? So I don't know if you hear something like that, that you can say, poetry is too archaic and technical for me. I mean, when you hear lines like, her bare throat made to bite, you know, and all her face was honey to my mouth, that's all you need for poetry, I think. Now I go to a very tragic and longer poem. This is by Robert Browning, Elizabeth Barrett's husband, 19th century. I don't have his names. He wrote a great deal of poetry. He's, in a way, the most intellectual of all the great poets. Very often he'll have sentiments with which you will passionately disagree. He's the author, for instance, of A Man's Reach Must Exceed His Grasp, Else What's a Heaven For, which Ayn Rand hated that line with a lifelong passion. But he's a great poet, and this particular poem is a love poem, but a tragic one. It's a ballad. So it's the only example I'm able to give you in this course of a story. That's what a ballad is, a story told in poetic as a poem. So I wanted you to get one, even though this is a very tragic one, and I wanted to get a Browning in because he's such a great poet. This one is anti-church, anti-pope, anti-priest. Just to give you the context here, the whole poem is a raging cry against injustice by the priest. Extremely dramatic, which is typical of Browning. It's pretty long. It's 13 stanzas, but I think the story will hold you. And just to let you know, the woman is speaking throughout, except when it's obvious that the priest is speaking, and she is caged in a jail cell. You'll find that out, but it's helpful to know that in advance. And I'll interject an explanatory comment briefly if it's essential, but I want to be so brief that you don't lose the rhythm and the rhyme. It's called The Confessional. And this is typical Browning. Just watch how it starts. It is a lie, their priests, their pope, their saints, their all they fear or hope are lies and lies. There through my door and ceiling there and walls and floor, their lies, they lie, shall still be hurled till spite of them I reach the world. You think priests just and holy men. Before they put me in this den, I was a human creature too, with flesh and blood like one of you, a girl that laughed in beauty's pride, like lilies in your world outside. And now her story. I had a lover, shame, avaunt. This poor, wretched body, grim and gaunt, was kissed all over till it burned by lips the truest. Love e'er turned his heart's own tint. One night they kissed my soul out in a burning mist. They kissed her soul out. She forgot God and everything for the love of the pleasures. So, she felt guilty. So next day, when the accustomed train of things grew round my sense again, that is a sin, I said, and slow with downcast eyes to church I go and pass to the confession chair and tell the old mild father there. But when I falter, Beltran's name, that's the man, Beltran. Ha, quoth the father, much I blame the sin. Yet wherefore idly grieve, this is the priest speaking, despair not, strenuously retrieve. Nay, I will turn this love of thine to lawful love, almost divine. So he's being nice, he's going to promise to make everything great. For he, the priest continued, for he is young and led astray, this Beltran, and he schemes, men say, to change the laws of church and state, so thine shall be an angel's fate, who, ere the thunder breaks, should roll its cloud away and save his soul. So she has a mission to save her lover's soul, which is what the church says it wants. Continue the priest, for when he lies upon thy breast, thou mayest demand and be possessed of all his plans, and next day steal to me, and all those plans reveal, that I and every priest to purge his soul may fast and use the scourge. Unquote. That father's beard was long and white. With love and truth his brow seemed bright. I went back all on fire with joy, and that same evening bade the boy tell me, as lovers should, heart-free, something to prove his love of me. He told me what he would not tell for hope of heaven or fear of hell, and I lay listening in such pride. And soon as he had left my side, tripped to the church by morning light to save his soul in his despite. I told the father all his schemes, who were his comrades, what their dreams. And now make haste, I said, to pray the one spot from his soul away. Tonight he comes, but not the same will look. At night he never came, nor next night. And the after morn I went forth with a strength newborn. The church was empty. Something drew my steps into the street. I knew it led me to the marketplace where, lo, on high, the father's face, that horrible black scaffold dressed, that stapled block, God sink the rest, that head strapped back, that blinding vest, those knotted hands and naked breast, till near one busy hangman pressed, and on the neck these arms caressed. No part in aught they, the priests, I'll have, no part in aught they hope or fear. No heaven with them, no hell, and here no earth, not so much space as pens my body in their worst of dens, but shall bear God and man my cry. Lies, lies again, and still they lie. Okay. Now that's an example of the power of Browning, and he's a brilliant poet, the most intellectual, as I say. If you read it aloud and you see every poem has a few little things that you don't quite get, so you have to untangle it first. This is a really powerful denunciation, a compelling story, and you can again appreciate the difference between poetry and prose. Because if I came in and told you in substance the same story, you know, there was a naive girl long ago, and she was so in love she felt it was a sin, and she was in love with a rebel, and the priest said, bring him in, and we will rub the spot from his soul. And unknown to her, they grabbed him and put him on a scaffold, and she was horrified and in jail, and she felt that she'd been betrayed. If I told you that, I'd say, oh, what, you know, a tragic story, you would nod, and that's it. But tell you the same content this way, and it's gripping, impassioned. Powerful thing. I don't know any other way to make poetry, the power of it, real, and to contrast like that what you would do in prose. Now, of course, you couldn't do Atlas Shrugged in prose, in poetry. So it has a power from its form that is not equalable here. To each his own. Everything has its limits. That's the law of identity. But I want you to grasp a bit of what poetry can do. Are you getting an idea simply of what the form of the sound of concepts, a medium built on that, the unique exploitation that a genius can make of that form? So you don't just throw away poetry as archaic and irrelevant. Now I want to stick in here some couple that I got, I left out yesterday because I ran out of time. One is to give you an example of blank verse. Now, blank verse is the type of verse used in the major epics and by Shakespeare in his plays, etc. It is rhythm without rhyme. Rhythm without rhyme. And it's usually that standard iambic pentameter. It has a definite meter, and the meter adds something. But as I say, I don't think that it has the effect of poetry. But there's a lot of wonderful things written in blank verse, so it's kind of the borderline between poetry and novels. And I want to read you excerpts from one of Tennyson that come under the category of presenting man the hero. This is Ulysses by Tennyson. It's if you know the Odyssey by Homer, so many of the great poems are based on episodes from Homer, which we don't know anymore. The mythology that used to be taught in the schools, the Greek and Roman mythology, is a total dead letter. So you need some little handbook on, I have a handbook, who's who in the Greek world and who's who in the Roman world. And you can look it up quickly. As you know, so if it's Ulysses and you don't know, you know that he sailed the seas for so many years and had all these adventures and he finally came home to this boring wife, Penelope, and he thought that he was the king, and he looked at these people and said, oh Christ, what am I doing here? You know, so this is just the start of it. It little profits that an idle, now remember there's no rhyme here, but it's meter. It little profits that an idle king by this still hearth among these barren crags, matched with an aged wife, I meet and dole on equal laws unto a savage race that hoard and sleep and feed and know not me. I cannot rest from travel. I will drink life to the lees. That's a big jump here. But in other words, he's stagnating. He can't take it. He wants to go off and drink life to the lees. And this is the most famous part of it, or the second most famous part of it, jumping forward. I am a part of all that I have met, yet all experience is an arch where through gleams that untraveled world whose margin fades forever and forever when I move. How dull it is to pause, to make an end, to rust unburnished, not to shine in use, as though to breathe were life. Life piled on life were all too little, and of one to me, little remains. But every hour is saved from that eternal silence, something more, a bringer of new things. And vile it were for some three suns, S.U., to store and hoard myself, and this gray spirit yearning in desire to follow knowledge like a sinking star beyond the utmost bound of human thought. So that is his passion, and later in the poem he decides he's going to give Telemachus, his son, can take over these savages, and he goes to his mariners and he says, you and I are old, but something ere the end, some work of noble note may yet be done. And then the most memorable part is the ending. Now, this was published, by the way, in 1842. This is appeal to the mariners at the end. Come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off, and sitting well in order, smite the sounding furrows. For my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be we shall touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles whom we knew. Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are, we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. That's Ulysses. There are certain lines in this that are so memorable for anybody approaching an older age. This should be your motto that you put up on the wall. Though much is taken, much abides. You've lost 50 years or you've used 50 years, there's still a lot to go. And there's this story that we heard that, how much of his work? That over half of his creative work was done, was started and done after he was 70. So, and then this last line, he's not content to strive and seek. He's not even content to strive and seek and be unyielding. That would be, you know, I'm the captain of my soul. The great thing, he's going to, in his old age, he's to strive, to seek, to find. He's going to get there and accomplish it. And then not to yield if there's any obstacles in the path. So it's a memorable poem. And even without the rhyme, I think you have to grant that it has a certain power. Now, of course, there, you're 100% sympathetic to the content. If you read Shakespeare, the rhythm does something. And of course, Shakespeare's beautiful elevated language, but the sentiments will curdle you rather than inspire you. Now here, I got a miscellaneous stuff I want you to hear. I can't really categorize it very well. This is a wistful little poem. Sad. The exact opposite of the hero of self-esteem. And I think I'll read it to you just by itself because it's such an eloquent, brief statement of a tragic plight, a sad, a wistful plight. A guy I never heard of wrote it, Thomas S. Jones, Jr., an American poet born in 1882. And it's called Sometimes. Across the fields of yesterday, he sometimes comes to me, a little lad just back from play, the lad I used to be. And yet he smiles so wistfully, once he has crept within, I wonder if he hopes to see the man I might have been. Isn't that sort of tragic? He knows he's betrayed his potential, but he has enough recognition of what he once was and such a brilliant idea. How would he as a child have looked at what he as a man became? And to express that complex of thought in eight lines, and what does it mean? Across the fields of yesterday. It's just the four beats. It's a short, packed with a wealth of meaning, which is an example of what poetry can do. Now, hopefully, that doesn't strike a chord on you, but in you. But if it does, you can still satisfy that kid. Because though much is taken, much abides. Now a few little gems on politics, just to show you that every, you know, shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings, everything you can write a poem on. If we had time, I have poems here on bouillabaisse. I have poems on my mistress's girdle, and how I would give anything to be able to put my arms where it goes in beautiful rhymes. I have a poem that I call The Metaphysics of Vodka. I mean, if we had time, there's just an endless amount, but I'm just picking a few here and there. And now a few from politics. Actually, three. This one is called Retaliation. And it is by Oliver Goldsmith, an Irish poet in the 18th century, 1728 to 1774. I think you'll get the theme of it. A profound thinker decides to go into politics. A man with a great philosophical mind decides, I got to do something, go into politics, and this is what happens. It's a short poem, a bitter poem, beautifully done. Here lies our good, he's dead, this is our rest in peace. Here lies our good Edmund, whose genius was such, we scarcely can praise it or blame it too much, who, born for the universe, narrowed his mind and to party, political party, and to party gave up what was meant for mankind. Though fraught with all learning, yet straining his throat to persuade Tommy Townsend to lend him a vote, who, too deep for his hearers, still went on refining and thought of convincing while they thought of dining. Though equal to all things, for all things unfit, too nice for a statesman, too proud for a wit, for a patriot too cool, for a drudge disobedient, and too fond of the right to pursue the expedient. So, if you decide to go into politics, to me, the best parts of this are, he's fraught with all learning, but he's straining his throat to get this creep to come out and vote. And the other one, he's deep and he's bent on refining in his ideas and convincing, and all they want is dining. You know, you can see the clash, and yet he wanted to accomplish something. Now here's another one, this time from Percy Bysshe. Is that how you say it? Bysshe Shelley. Isn't this Mary Shelley's husband, and she was the author of Frankenstein, right? But basically not based on him. He's also a wonderful poet, has all kinds of stuff. 1792 to 1822, so he did an immense amount in 30 years. And this is an example of how you can use poetry to your own purposes. In other words, he's addressing the feudal serfs of England, and he's telling them, shake off the lords. So if you read that just straight, you think, well, you know, it's just a historical interest. But you can take the exact same thing symbolically, turn it to your context and your time, and think of it as the bureaucrats, the Clintons, etc., that are robbing you blind, and you are the equivalent of the feudal serfs. And if you read it from that point of view, it takes on a battle call, battle cry type of meaning. So I'm just going to give you a few stanzas. Song to the men of England. It starts with a bad rhyme. Plow and low. Men of England, wherefore plow for the lords who lay ye low? Wherefore weave with toil and care the rich robes your tyrants wear? Wherefore feed and clothe and save from the cradle to the grave those ungrateful drones who would drain your sweat, nay, drink your blood? And then just here's the moral. Now here's two stanzas, the problem and the solution. The seed ye sow, another reaps. The wealth ye make, another keeps. The robes ye weave, another wears. The arms ye forge, another bears. Sow seed, but let no tyrant reap. Make wealth, let no impostor keep. Weave robes, let not the idle wear. Forge arms in your defense to bear. There's a lot of hymns to liberty that are not couched in 20th century context, but they're so easy to translate into a 20th century context if you want to do it. Just to do, make the substitutions, and then the poem takes on a tremendous relevance. And because poetry is like philosophy, it's generally universal. All you have to grasp is what the mythological figure is or what the period is, and then you can immediately say how it applies today. Here's four lines that somebody sent to the radio show. It's by somebody called Ebenezer Elliott. And all I know is it's Epigram 1831. Four lines. What is a communist? One who hath yearnings for equal division of unequal earnings. Idle, idler, or bungler, or both, he is willing to fork out his copper and pocket your shilling. That's a cute one for communism. Now I want to read you a truly funny poem, as that as a transition, coming to the end of the ones that I'm able to get in. This is by Ogden Nash, but this is a long, with a serious theme and a hilarious form of treatment. He identifies morality and virtue with the Christian conventional code, sacrifice, misery, duty, give up, etc. But he can't stand it. He has no idea of another code. He just simply rebels against it. And just listen to the witty rhymes and the whole way, the originality of his. It's fairly lengthy. It's called Kind of an Ode to Duty. Now, some language, he deliberately uses hast thou because he's going to play that off with real colloquialisms. So part of the humor is going to be the clash of styles. So don't think, as soon as it has a biblical element, hast thou, oh, I can't understand that. You know, it just means have you. That's all it means. I'm deleting a few words which are don't affect the meter, but are completely unknown to your generation. But I just wanted to tell you that, you know what a Tartar is? Oriental, really mean, overbearing type. Do you know what an Houri is? H-O-U-R-I? A beautiful Arabian dancing girl. So with those slight emendations, here is most of Kind of an Ode to Duty. Oh, duty! Why hast thou not the visage of a sweetie or a cutie? Why displayest thou the countenance of the kind of conscientious organizing spinster that the minute you see her, you are against her? Why glitter thy spectacles so ominously? Why art thou clad so abominously? Why art thou so different from Venus? And why do thou and I have so few interests mutually in common between us? See what he does by stretching meters and clothes. Why art thou 50% martyr and 51% tartar? Why is it thy unfortunate wont to try to attract people by calling on them either to leave undone the deeds they like or to do the deeds they won't. They don't. Why art thou so like an April post-mortem on something that died in the autumn? Above all, why dost thou continue to hound me? Why art thou always albatrossly hanging around me? Here's the best two lines coming. Thou so ubiquitous, and I so iniquitous. I seem to be the one person in the world thou art perpetually preaching at who or to who. Whatever looks like fun, there art thou standing between me and it, calling yoo-hoo. Oh, duty, duty, how noble a man should I be, hadst thou the visage of a sweetie or a cutie. Were thou but houri instead of hag, then would my halo indeed be in the bag. But as it is, thou art so much forbiddinger than the forbiddingest ant, that in the words of the poet, when duty whispers, lo, thou must, this youth replies, I just can't. That's it. Now, you can overdose on Ogden Nash, and of course he is not the greatest poet, but in terms of what he does, he is. So I strongly recommend you get this big, thick green book called, I think, The Complete Works of Ogden Nash, that's in print. And you just, you know, instead of trying to read it in sequence, just open it and read aloud. Some, a lot of them are pretty dated. They make references to stuff that is from the 30s or 40s that even I don't exactly know. And a lot of it will pass by, but a lot of it is like this. And it has really good philosophic themes. There was one I wanted to read you about people who think they think. And it's all rhymed and it's very clever, but we just can't do it. I want to read you a few last ones. I promised you a longer question period. By the way, just out of curiosity, how many of you have questions that you'd like to ask that are not related to poetry? Because I did open the doors to that. I'd just like to see by a show of hands. You put it right up. Don't be... I can only find a couple. Well, what I'll do is come to the end, take questions, and then if we still have a little time, I'll read you a few more at the end that I've had to leave out. I want to read a few last ones that I like for personal reasons. This one is called The Dying Speech of an Old Philosopher. It's by Walter Savage Landor, L-A-N-D-O-R, and I don't have his date, unfortunately. Now, the best way to contrast this is if you know the poem by Dylan Thomas, Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night, which a lot of objectivists think is good, because, you know, he says, rage, denounce death, don't allow it, you know, which is, you know, stamping your foot at reality. And I think that poem is philosophically bad. But here's what I think is the dying speech of an old philosopher that I could take my hat off to. Four lines. You have to interpret it, but still. I strove with none, for none was worth my strife. Nature I loved, and next to nature, art. I warmed both hands before the fire of life. It sinks, and I am ready to depart. So isn't that great? If you translate that, he strove with none because he had too high an opinion of himself. It doesn't mean he didn't have, you know, battles and so on, but he didn't regard his life as a metaphysical war against the world. Nobody was equal to him. So that's self-esteem. Nature he loved, that's reality. And next to nature, art, which I take as values, man's embodiment of values. And then the generalization, I warmed both hands before the fire of life. So it's life was his top value, but he accepts reality. It sinks, you know, I'm getting old, death is coming, and I am ready to depart. So it's perfect, self-esteem, reality, values, life, acceptance of reality. And in four lines, so that to me would be, if I was strong enough, I'd quote that as my last breath. Now, I also want to mention a couple of very brief poems. It's actually, therefore, four, because Eric gave me a two-line poem, which is fabulous, right on this theme. I love poems which are in praise of great men, and especially brief ones. And I found this terrific little four-line poem by John Bannister Tabb, T-A-B-B, called Beethoven and Angelo. In other words, Michelangelo. And you wonder, what the heck in four lines could somebody say in rhyme to capture what Beethoven and Michelangelo both achieved? And you know, it's not so incongruous to put these two together, because much as I worship Michelangelo, he did have a tragic or malevolent element, which is much stronger in Beethoven. But they do, you know, they're both gigantic masters with a certain... Michelangelo, I think, is more emphasis on the heroic, but Beethoven has that too. But anyway, this is four lines. One made the surging sea of tone subservient to his rod. One from the sterile womb of stone raised children unto God. In other words, each of them were able to mold and master nature, the mass of tone and his rod, his baton, and it fell totally under his control. And one took this, you know, boulders and granite and stone everywhere, and he made children of God. He made man out of it. And it's such a powerful and such a natural rhyme. But now topping that is this one that Eric gave me. And I made him swear not to use it in his course on the American Enlightenment. This is by Alexander Pope, another great poet. You'd probably know him from Know Thyself, Presume Not God to Scan, The Proper Study of Mankind is Man. Anyway, this is his tribute to a great physicist that Dave Harriman has already explained why he deserves this tribute. Fabulous two lines. See if you could do a tribute to Ayn Rand in two lines. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light. Is that terrific? So you have a party sometime where you take great people and just have to write a couplet. That's called a heroic couplet. Just two. It has to rhyme and have the right meter and some content, you know. Now, I'm going to conclude my formal presentation, but look, I've got all this plus another whole folder here. This is one I like personally. It's not a great poem, but I personally really like it. It's by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, an American, 19th century, right? It's a well-known poem, but I want to show you a gimmick after I read it. The Arrow and the Song. Do you know, how many know that poem? Oh, you don't know that? Oh, that's a very famous poem. Now, first I'm just going to read it as written. Then I'm going to make a few changes. But first I just read it as written. I shot an arrow into the air. It fell to earth, I know not where. For so swiftly it flew, the sight could not follow it in its flight. I breathed a song into the air. It fell to earth, I know not where. For who has sight so keen and strong that it can follow the flight of song? Long, long afterward, in an oak, I found the arrow still unbroke. And the song from beginning to end, I found again in the heart of a friend. So it's the poem to me is the struggle of the creative person. And you're turning something new loose on the world. You can't see where it goes or who it affects. And what Ayn used to say, her novels were like bread cast on the waters, using the biblical image. She did not know what would come back. And every creative person has to feel that to some extent. Because he says, long, long afterward, it takes who knows how long. And then In what form are you going to see it? So I thought, since I always identified with this poem, why not have some fun with it? He's dead. And I feel that it's strongly applicable to me. I mean, I'm being presumptuous, but I feel I've done some creative work. So I kept the essence and just changed the song to my form of word. And I don't put this forth as great poetry, but I put it forth to show you that one fun thing to do is take a poem and just rewrite little parts of it, keeping the rhyme and the meter, so that it's more directly autobiographical for you. And you can have fun with it that way, and as long as you realize, you know, his work is, still has its integrity and you're having a party game, you can have a lot of fun with this. So this is mine. I assume you know the publisher of The Ominous Parallels. If not, you'll find out. Now my first stanza, almost all of it is the same. It's just a word here. My first stanza is the same. I shot an arrow into the air. It fell to earth, I know not where. For so swiftly it flew, the sight could not follow it in its flight. I sent a book to Stein and Day. It fell in hands. Whose? Who can say? For who has sight so keen in reach that it can follow the flight of speech? Long, long afterward in an oak I found the arrow still unbroke, and the book from beginning to end I found again in the mind of a friend. I really recommend you try to do that. It's fun, it's not hard, because you have to create a poem on your own. Is very, very difficult. I mean, it's possible. And it's easy in the sense that it's brief. But Ayn Rand once told me that there's only two forms of art which you should either be a genius or stay away from. That you can have a reputable talent as a novelist or a musician, etc. But can you guess the two forms of art, she said, are so exquisitely demanding that if you're not a genius, you come across as an inept moron. Can you guess which two she picked out? Poetry was one, and dance was the other. Right. So if you're not Nureyev or Browning, you enter, you know, cautiously. You don't have to read it, you know, to 300 people. Do it at a party, have a few glasses of wine, and that is really the last that I want to do. Actually, I want to do, oh gosh, I've got so many good ones here. I've got inspirational poems. I've got the Song of Roland, which is written in French, in Old French. Do you know the story of the Song of Roland? It's written in 800. It's about the Crusade, where the Christians went to slay the Saracens, the infidels, basically to keep Europe free of Islam, which I think is a great intention. I have to read you. Can I just read you in conclusion a little bit from the Song of Roland? Now, this is a French epic, and they're celebrating the strength of Roland, his courage. It's the earliest epic we have after Greece and Rome. It's written sometimes in the 700s and 800s, and the thing, they're devout Christians, you know, and they're out to save the world for Christianity, but what is so terrific is they haven't the faintest guilt. They wouldn't dream of turning the other cheek. They wouldn't forgive the infidels for a second. They're utterly convinced of the rightness, and it's pretty gory, but I relish it in the context of today's world where everybody is bleeding over the poor criminal and he might suffer when he dies, you know. This is the kind of righteousness that made the West, even though It's in a Christian context. Remember, it's 700 or 800, so they're not exactly what you'd call spiritual. They're physical, and they're dealing with perceptual physical reality. What's fantastic about this is it's written in old French, and Dorothy Sayers, the mystery novelist, translated the whole thing into rhyme in English. And it, to me, it's very good. So I'll just read you. Durandal is his sword. They all named their sword. They're riding horseback. And Chernobyl is his main enemy. And it's an epic. So it's got to have the kind of meter that goes there galloping along. Great is the battle and crowded the melee, nor does Count Roland stint of his strokes this day. While the shaft holds, he wields his spear amain, 15 great blows ere it splinters and breaks. Then his brand, his Durandal, he takes. Against Chernobyl's, he spurs his steed in haste, splits through the helm with carbuncles ablaze, through the guy's steel coif and through scalp and through brain. Twixt the two eyes, he cleaves him through the face, right through the body, through the fork and the rein, down through the saddle. With its beaten gold plates, through to the horse, he drives the cleaving blade. Seeking no joint, through the sheen carves his way, flings horse and man dead on the grassy plain, and says, "Foul be foul felon that e'er you sought this fray, Manhoon," that's his the Islam god, "Manhoon," quoth he, "shall never bring you aid. Villains like you seek victory in vain." That's a spirit, you see. And just this one little addendum, the archbishop is in attendance. And does he say, you know, turn the other cheek, forgive until 70 times 7? Quoth the archbishop, well done indeed. Valor like this becomes a knight of breed that bears his arms and sits a goodly steed. Forward and fierce in battle should he be, else he's not worth a single penny piece. Best he turn monk in monastery meek and for our sins pray deadly on his knees. In other words, if you're no good as a knight, then become a monk and pray. But, you know, you're... I love that. I read the whole thing from beginning to end, and you read it aloud, and you get involved, and it's such satisfaction when he cuts the guy right through the brains and the body. It just takes all the Christianity out of you. And yet it's a purely Christian epic. The Dorothy Sayers did the undoable there of translating it into modern, understandable English. And it's exciting. It's a thin book. All right, I'm going to take some questions now. And then if we have time, give you random. But please ask your questions. Don't stint. Just because you know there's more, because we could go on forever. Who's ready? Over there.
Testing. Would you prefer a question about philosophy in the extreme future, circular time, or scientific induction?
Circular time I know nothing about. Induction I know very little about. So let's talk about philosophy in the extreme future. Okay, which is far from what I know about. Yeah.
Miss Rand said that her other name for objectivism is philosophy for living on Earth.
Yes.
So in the extreme future, when mankind basically possesses the entire universe and we start to run out of the finite material... I'm not trying to justify any kind of current environmentalism. I'm trying to fight it. But... what would philosophy be in those extreme days, in an extreme future?
How would we solve the problem that mankind is so populous that we have covered every habitable place in the entire universe, throughout every galaxy?
Right.
If you can project that, then I can project it. By that time, they will have invented an ether that is so powerful that 1,000 people can live with absolute living and breathing space in 1 square inch. And the more people, the better our inventions. Yeah.
I once had an objectivist who knew something about art criticize a poem by saying it was just verse. Well, is there such a distinction?
No, that's disgusting. Okay. That's like criticizing a novel because it's just a story, criticizing a concerto because it's just a melody. You know, that's disgusting. That's a way of putting down rhyme and saying poetry is something exalted, like, I took it. I wanted the money, but I took it, you know. Out, totally out. And the person that said that, if they're over 18, I would have very grave qualms about their moral character. Betsy.
Yes, have you considered song lyrics as poetry? And if so, do you have any favorites?
No, I never have. A lot of poems are called songs, and of course poetry more started as singing, but I only go by collections, and I've never bought a collection of songs. Because my experience is that the words are secondary to the music. There may be good lyrics, but I've never looked into that.
I'm just curious about the name of the poem that you edited out of today's speech.
I didn't give it a name of my own. You mean what his name was?
No, the one that, the physical poem that you wouldn't read.
Oh, Rizpah, R-I-Z-P-A-H.
Nope.
Oh, the Love and Sleep.
Who is that by?
Swinburne.
What's the one you didn't read?
What's the other one you didn't read?
Right.
Correct.
Thinker.
Which one didn't I read?
It was...
Oh. I didn't bring it. There's one, an ode to my mistress's breasts. I'm sure you could get it on the internet. There's an awful lot of poems like that, ranging from tasteful appreciation of the body and even the genitals, down to non-tasteful appreciation, down to outright pornography. Yes.
My question is related to the previous question. You said that you were not going to read that poem because of your emotional response to it, and you fear you'd cry. You mentioned some comments about the tears of joy on your show, and I wondered, do you think that the tearful and sobbing response to something of great value is a expression of the present culture, and would that response have been found in ancient Greece?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. I have a malevolent streak, and it could very well be that part of the tears come from a lifetime battle, and a truly lifetime battle, because I was, at war with the world basically before I met Ayn Rand. So I had a strong element of bitterness. And it could very well be that contributes to it, although this particular poem is a total tragedy. And if you feel, I think it's natural to cry at that. I don't think, your point is, if you had a completely benevolent culture, what there would not be is tears at a wedding. Tears at a wedding is a definite sign of malevolence, because at a wedding you should be happy. But tears at a wedding is a sign that is amounts to a statement, this is the way life should be. It's so beautiful, but of course it can't be. This is an exception. How tragic. And therefore you cry, you're mourning the contrast between this moment of exaltation, solemnity, beauty, flowers and so on, with ordinary humdrum life. That would not be in a benevolent culture. But in any culture that holds values, their loss at the hands of injustice, that in a form that is made real to you, would necessarily provoke some kind of emotional expression if you're not a total repressor. It would evoke tears, I think. But then you say to me, well, why not? If that's a rational response, why not do it in public? And the exact answer to that question is sex is rational. That doesn't mean you do it in public. There are such things as emotional responses that are private, that you feel comfortable in expressing only with one person, in the case of sex, or with a small group of intimates whom you can expose yourself to in that way, whom you want to. I don't particularly want, nobody can want 300 people to be their soulmate. But if they're not relatively close like that, why would I want to do it? They can read the poem themselves. It's not inherent in the assignment. I should never have mentioned it. It's just that she asked me, name some poems by Tennyson, and it was in my mind, I couldn't avoid it. That's all I want to say about Rizpah or Tears. And even if you got a copy of it, which I know somebody did, I'm not reading it. That's it. Yes.
Did Bill Clinton win in Yugoslavia? This is just a rhetorical question.
Well, what do I think of him going into Yugoslavia?
Did he win in Yugoslavia?
Did he win?
Yeah.
No. He did not win. He left a total disaster, which was inevitable from the beginning. Everything about that war was wrong. Everything, including starting with the fact that it's a civil war of which both sides were culpable of atrocities. Now, Milosevic is no hero and is a former communist. But every group there, and go wider in the whole Slavic area, the Balkans, is guilty of age-old atrocities against every other group. They're notorious for everybody hating everybody and everybody trying to dispossess everybody. And for any foreign power, this has no strategic significance, no oil, no nothing. For any foreign power that's civilized to put a foot in that, a nickel or a soldier, is an atrocity, a moral atrocity, because it amounts to saying, here is this age-old group of roving savage tribes that no one will pacify unless you chain them up. And we are going to spend the lives and treasure and the cruise missiles and the means of self-defense of our country for no reason whatever than to leave a, quote, legacy for a lying adulterer in the history books. And that is all it's for, to say peace in our time, like Neville Chamberlain. We stopped this atrocity. We're still apologizing because Bush went into Kuwait and stopped the seizure of oil, because he did it for oil, which was a selfish reason. But here, you were going in as a suicide mission with nothing to gain, as in Somalia or Haiti, etc. That's what Clinton specializes in, turning the army into social workers for no reason whatever, for no purpose and no end. Now you say, okay, aren't the Serbs out of Kosovo? They're going as fast as hell because they're being slaughtered by the Albanians as they come back. And NATO, one of the most abominable organizations in the history of man, which should be disbanded yesterday, 100%, and all Belgian bureaucrats of it removed from office, and as far as I'm concerned, from life. NATO has now put themselves in the position, they have introduced Russia into the Balkans with a footing in Kosovo. They've taken the side of the Islamics in Kosovo. They have unleashed a perpetual civil war where the Albanians are now going to slaughter the Serbians. There is no way to pacify it. They're going to have American troops, innocent boys who volunteered to save their country, stationed there 10, 20, 30, 40 years, and every time they step foot in, they're going to be shot, so they don't dare step foot in, so they're going to stand there and watch the slaughter. And the other tribes are going to get in on it. It's going to be a nightmare. It's wrong, evil, badly motivated, insanely carried out. Can you believe the civilized countries of the world with their weapons? Number one saying, we have to fly very high, too high to see the targets, because we don't want a casualty. Because if there was a casualty of one of our pilots, the Americans wouldn't accept it. Well, of course they wouldn't accept it because they don't accept the war. So they fly at stratospheric heights and they hit, you know, makeshift targets. They make holes in the ground week after week, and they release the news how well they're doing. And then the next week the report comes in, they really hit only sand dunes, but next week for sure we're bringing in more. It's no mystery how they hit the Chinese embassy. It's amazing that they hit a building. Finally, after how many months, they decided to drop more bombs. And they massed troops on the border, and they made a deal with Milosevic. At the same time, they call him a war criminal, too depraved to deal with, which is true, and at the same time, they want to sit down at the table and negotiate a deal with him. NATO was created, allegedly, as an alliance to protect us against Russia. And now it's in partnership with Russia to protect the Albanians against the Serbs. Now, if anybody has to ask, I don't blame you for asking. It is beyond, if you put it in an operetta, you know, operettas are denounced because the plots are unbelievable. They're too silly. You couldn't put it in an operetta. You couldn't put it in a Hollywood farce with, what's his name, Carrey? Jim Carrey. It would not be believable. And this is our foreign policy and Clinton's triumph. I mean, this makes Monica an achievement by Congress. Did I make my viewpoint clear? Pardon?
I meant it as a rhetorical
thing. Oh, wow. Yes.
In a society like this, like Yugoslavia, how do you promote a change? And does objectivism has any role in making a difference?
You couldn't promote a change in Yugoslavia directly anymore. Then you could promote a change in the inhabitants of a lunatic asylum. Now, you can create the kind of culture that doesn't breed lunatics. You can create means of therapy, but that requires a certain kind of culture. The West has already thrown out anything which would serve as an example, anything which you could export to teach these people. We are rushing to embrace all the ideas of mysticism and collectivism that has led them to be those kind of savage tribes. So there's nothing you could do. And at that stage, it wouldn't make any difference if you sat everyone in that country, Serbs and Albanians and every other group, down, chained them, forced them to read Atlas Shrugged and the Fountainhead, and then tested them. With death as the penalty, if not, so they had to come. You think that would make a difference? A, they wouldn't get it. B, if they got it, they'd think it's horrible. And C, they'd say, I like Atlas because it's a thick book and I can smash the head of the guy next to me. So objectivism has a role in the most incredibly indirect way. It has the same role it has in civilizing the Indians in the West. You start your own society, you function rationally, you kill off the ones that won't follow you, and the others follow you. That's it. You go to Yugoslavia, if it had any resources, you settle businesses there, you tell the natives, kill yourself off on the side, not near our property. And then the bad ones are gone, and the good ones say, could we get a job? And after a while, you that's it, but you don't give them philosophy. And it's not going to be in your lifetime, believe me. Even if you're only 12. Now we solve the problem of Europe, Asia.
Yes.
Is there any Republican candidate you would support for the presidency?
No. And I'll tell you why. I came out for Forbes the last time around. When was that? In one of the primary periods. I guess the last election. He had a lot of really good, unusual stands in economics. And he was woozy enough on abortion so I could swallow it. You know, he kind of said he's against abortion, but the state shouldn't do it, and it should be an issue of persuasion. I actually interviewed him on my radio show, and I asked him two questions, essentially. I said, I and my audience are looking for a principled secular Republican. That is somebody who is for freedom on principle, not pragmatically that they'll, you know, get rid of it, and who's not, doesn't tie it all to God, even if they believe in religion. And he gave me the most waffling answers ever on both questions. Of course you have to be for principle, but you have to face the reality, you know, of what can you do when you deal with people who disagree with you. And of course there's this world, but God gave us our rights and we can't ignore it. It was, you know, yes and no and maybe and both. So I was disappointed. But now, subsequent to that, he has come out openly with the Christian Coalition with the idea he needs a mass base and he's going to get it from religion. So that's dead as far as I'm concerned. Of course, Buchanan is a fascist. So he's out. He's a protectionist, racist, nationalist. So he's out. And Elizabeth Dole, I wouldn't even talk about.
What about
you? I mean, she's properly married. That's all I could say is denunciation of her. Who else? Bush.
Oh, God.
W.
What about John Kasich?
This is a man that stands for nothing, W. Bush, except the Grecians. You know, if you've heard him speak, that's his knowledge of foreign policy. He didn't know that people from Greece were called Greeks. And a few things like that. But he has advisors. And when anybody asks him a question, like, you know, what are you going to do about the Serbo-Croatians? He has this little card and he looks down and he says, we have to make them self-sustaining so that they don't continue to need aid, which they will need for a short time. So he's got a bromide that satisfies left and right, and he calls it compassion. A horrible creature. I wouldn't vote for him against Gore. Never. That'll put Bush, the old Bush, you know, who was the, I wouldn't even say it, him and his baker, who was that great columnist, Rosenthal in the Times, called them Bush Baker because they were one entity. Really evil pragmatists would put them in the saddle with this kid who doesn't know his from. As far as who else did you say? Kasich? Yeah. I don't know much about him, but I've seen bad things. Religious, strong religious things from him, so I'm waiting to see. And the same is true for Archer, but they don't seem to have the personality to have a chance to make it. So right now, I don't see anybody. And in fact, the race I'm more interested in is Giuliani versus Hillary. And that is the most disastrous race in the country, more so than the presidential race, which is going to be a disaster anyway. But that race is impossible for anyone to tell who to vote for if you live in New York. Hillary speaks for herself, but Giuliani was the man who prosecuted Michael Milken. He's the prosecutor who slaughtered businessmen, innocent, creative businessmen, knowingly, in order to get where he is. So he literally got where he is by stepping over dead bodies. He is the real-life Wesley Mouch, who double-crossed Reardon to rise to power. And he calls himself a Republican. So you ponder this one. If I had to vote in New York, I'd vote for Hillary Clinton. Because whoever wins that race is going to run for president. But if Hillary runs, there's a good chance she'll lose because she's too extreme a leftist. if Giuliani runs, there's too good a chance that he'll succeed, because he's positioned himself as a moderate. He's against crime. He's got the conservatives on his side. He's got the police on his side. He's got the liberals on his side. And you see Republicans. Republicans have no brain at all. And consequently, they contribute millions to anybody who will utter some sound out of the Bible that sounds like they can endorse it. And Giuliani would be a lot brighter on that than W. So that's my hopeful. Now, I know there's a course you're taking on the benevolent universe. I hope that this doesn't upset it, but I have to answer these questions that are asked me. Yes, at the back. Don't you have to come up? Yeah.
Well, I don't think I need the mic. What was the title of the Percy Bysshe Shelley poem? Do you have that handy?
Yeah. What was that? Love and Sleep? Song of the Men of England. Song of the Men of England. Well, I got a few minutes if you... Oh, okay. Yes.
You said if you had to vote in New York, you'd vote for Hillary, but can you make it clear to everybody they don't have to vote?
You don't have to vote, but this is the thing. One of them is going to win. So you're just letting other people decide. If you actually have a preference for whatever diabolical reason, you may as well not just wait for other people to satisfy your preference. Go and vote your preference. You know, then you can go to confessional. And, I mean, it would be horrible if she got in because of, you know, my vote. But on the other hand, it would be more horrible if Giuliani did.
I know you talked about the Republicans. I'd still like to hear your opinion, like, about Gore. I know he's an environmentalist and so forth, but, like, which is worse out of Bush and Gore? Or just not vote?
Oh, I wouldn't vote. Which is worse? They're both horrible, but Bush carries the mantle of being moderate, conservative, etc. So it would wipe out the Republican Party definitively. The Democrat Party is already wiped out. So Gore will just continue the wiping out. Plus, he will bear the cross of Monica for his whole 4 years. No matter how much he trots out his wife, Tipper, and his daughters, and his family with all their cancers, etc. He is still just another Clinton. He's a Clinton protege. And he'll never be anything but that, and that's good. A wounded incumbent is what we want. So that, to me, is a reason for voting for Gore. He's horrible, but he won't get... I predicted when it was Clinton versus some other horrible Republican, vote for Clinton because he will not get in very much, and he didn't. You know, if Bush, the old Bush, had got in, we would have complete socialized medicine in this country now. It's only because a Democrat did it that some Republicans felt, okay, they'll fight it. And even they didn't fight it at the beginning. What's his name, the old creep, Dole, was going around the country saying he's in favor of Clinton's plan at the beginning. And then some doctors protested, and the insurance companies protested, and suddenly the Republicans said, Jesus Christ, there's an issue here. You know? Which if Bush had raised it, which he certainly would, because he's a Christian dyed-in-the-wool. Not just a preaching one. I mean, he doesn't just talk, he means it. We would have had socialized medicine completely. If Clinton even cut back welfare to a certain extent. So I was right about that, and I predict that between Gore and Bush, at the end of 4 years, Bush will have the country in a much worse state than Gore. Now, the only difference is this. There are some businesses which Bush will treat better than Gore because they have alliance with Republicans. And I feel sorry for those businesses. And in self-interest, I think people in those businesses should vote for Bush because they want to survive. But I have no such business. And I have to concern myself with the country as I'm going to live in it. And to me, I get no benefit from either, but a total disaster from the Republicans. Yes.
Quick follow-up. My concern was with, I know the Republicans, I guess, have the House. And if Bush got in power, they, I guess, want to repeal, they want to make abortion illegal.
They'll never get an abortion amendment passed.
Okay.
But it is, your point is correct. It's much better to have a divided government, the executive in one hand and the Congress in the other, because then there are continuous warfare and they don't get anything much done. And the only thing you can hope for from government is paralysis. So if there was a way of arranging it, I'd rather a Republican Congress and Hillary as president. And hopefully a chauvinistic Congress, but you know, go and find a male chauvinist anymore. Yes.
After this discussion, it seems somehow appropriate to ask you to read the poem about vodka.
Okay. Let me just tell you as I'm going, there's a good poem that I found in Ayn Rand's works called It's All a State of Mind, which she got from the magazine of Success in March 1963. Look it up. There's a terrific ballad called The Highwayman by Alfred Noyes, N-O-Y-E-S. There's a good ode to America called America for Me by Henry Van Dyke. And here is the drinking one. It's just called Drinking. So I'll have to make this. I can't see how to get another one. Is there another shorter one? Oh, here's one on the girdle. That, by the way, is by Edmund Waller, W-A-L-L-E-R. And then there's a nice inspirational one called Be Strong by Maltby Davenport Babcock. And then there's a nice one called Opportunity by John James Ingalls, where opportunity says, in effect, grab me now or you'll never get me again. And then there's this, I'll give you this one on drinking to see if you like it. I call it the metaphysics of vodka. He just calls it drinking. And he surveys the whole universe and comes to a conclusion. The thirsty earth, this is not great poetry, but I like vodka. He's 17th century, 1618 to 1667. Abraham Cowley, C-O-W-L-E-Y. The thirsty earth soaks up the rain and drinks and gapes for drink again. The plants suck in the earth and are with constant drinking fresh and fair. The sea itself, which one would think should have but little need of drink, drinks 10,000 rivers up, so filled that they o'erflow the cup. The busy sun, and one would guess by his drunken, fiery face no less, drinks up the sea, and when he's done, the moon and stars drink up the sun. They drink and dance by their own light, they drink and revel all the night. Nothing in nature's sober found, but an eternal health goes round. Fill up the bowl then, fill it high. Fill up the glasses there. For why should every creature drink but I? Why, man of morals, tell me why? And I'm going to give you just a little excerpt in final conclusion from Ogden Nash's poem, Lines Fraught with Naught But Thought. Just the middle of it. If of chaos we are on the brink, it is because so many people only think that they think. In truth, of anything other than thinking they are fonder, because thought requires the time and effort to reflect, cogitate, contemplate, meditate, ruminate, and ponder. Their minds are exposed to events and ideas, but they have never pondered or reflected on them, any more than motion picture screens meditate on the images that are projected on them. Hence our universal confusion, the result of the unreasoned or jumped at conclusion. That's pretty good epistemology. And on that note, thank you very much.